From the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin, welcome to The Surgery Set. I'm Jonathan Kohler, an assistant professor in pediatric surgery here in Madison. I'm new here, and with this podcast, I'm exploring the ideas, inventions, and innovations of our department, plus meeting a lot of really interesting people. I'm excited for you to join me.
Hello, everyone. I'm Daniel Abbott, a surgical oncologist and health sciences researcher at the University of Wisconsin. This morning, we're very excited to guest host this episode of The Surgery Set. Our guest today is Dr. James Economo, a professor of surgery and division chief of surgical oncology at the University of California, Los Angeles. For more than two decades, Dr. Economo has conducted NIH-funded complex cell and gene therapy-based clinical investigations in melanoma and hepatocellular carcinoma. Dr. Economo, in full disclosure, is a co-founder of Kite Pharmaceuticals, and today we may be discussing non-FDA-approved interventions for cancer care. So, Dr. Economo, welcome to the Surgery Set podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So this morning at Grand Rounds, you talk about your decades-long forays into cell-based immunotherapy. And to start with the science portion of all this, you were an MD, PhD at Johns Hopkins. You could have chosen a research career in any genre. How did you choose cancer immunology?
When I started out in medical school, I worked in a laboratory headed by Mel Williams, who was a transplant surgeon, but he was interested in tumor immunology. And Mac Holmes was one of the senior residents who had spent time at the NCI surgery branch. And my father was a leading cancer surgeon in Chicago at Rush Medical School. And it's interesting that sometimes role models help to direct one's life's work. And so I think that if my father and if Dr. Williams and Dr. Holmes had been fruit fly geneticists, then I would have become a fruit fly geneticist because I admired them so much. And a role model is someone that you want to emulate and you want to be like. And I said, these are very impressive individuals and I'd like to be more like them. And so that's how I got interested in tumor immunology. And that's the reason I went into an MD PhD program at Hopkins and spent 4 years in the 1970s doing tumor immunology.
So you've devoted your whole life to this, and certainly it's been a life of discovery, and there's a lot left to go. From of knowing nothing about cancer immunology to we are so close to curing everybody with cancer, where do you think that we currently are? Are we 10% of the way there? Are we 90% of the way there?
I wish I could agree with you that we're almost at the point of being able to cure all cancer. We've made very significant advances, and all of this has been due to our improved understanding of the basic science of cancer. So it's important for the listeners to appreciate that scientists who study fruit flies study genes in fruit flies that actually are also in the human genome, and some of these are actually important in cancer biology. And so all of the advances that we've made in cancer therapeutics, whether it's immune-based therapies, small molecules, chemotherapy, it's all the result of having basic scientists undertaking curiosity-driven research and undercover clues and insights in basic cell biology that allows us then to translate these into benefit for patients.
Something you alluded to this morning during your Grand Rounds delivery was that certain tumors are more or less susceptible to some of this immunotherapy or cell-based gene therapy, and some of the notorious ones that probably are most easily targeted would be melanoma, hepatocellular carcinoma, renal cell carcinoma, whereas colorectal cancer might not be. What do you think are some of the other malignancies that are notoriously difficult, for example, perhaps pancreas cancer or others that you think might benefit particularly?
So all cancers are genetic diseases. They are the result of mutations in the DNA that are caused by carcinogens or environmental exposure or simply random mutations. Cancers have hundreds to thousands of mutations, and some of those mutations, a finite number of them, actually affect genes called oncogenes that actually cause the cancer phenotype. We now believe that cancers that have a lot of mutations are recognized by the immune system as being more foreign than cancers that have few mutations. So melanoma, Merkel cell cancer, non-small cell lung cancer, a number of other cancers have high mutational loads, and these are the cancers that respond very well to checkpoint inhibitors and immune-based therapies. Other cancers have fewer mutations, and these are the ones in which will be more challenging to be able to address with immune-based therapies. We also know that combining small molecules that may interrupt cancer signaling pathways in combination with surgery, radiation therapy, and with immune-based therapy may actually move the needle towards better and more durable responses for some of these other malignancies.
The challenges of discovery and implementation, specifically in gene therapy, are well documented over the last couple of decades. And certainly, not only at institutional levels, but at federal levels, there are a lot of regulatory hurdles. What are some of the frustrations that you see, maybe not so much with immunotherapy, but with gene-based therapy, that are going to have to be overcome, you know, both at a scientific level, but also just at a societal acceptance level?
So these regulatory requirements are all sound. They're scientifically based, and they're evaluated by superior clinical and basic scientists. And so all of the approvals that we have to get at an institutional level and at a federal level to conduct these gene therapy trials, and as I mentioned in my Grand Rounds presentation, I led the first gene therapy trial west of the Appalachians in the early 1990s. They are all designed to be able to weigh potential benefit to human subjects against the risks, because we naturally want to help patients but not place them at risk in the process. I think that these are all responsible and well thought out. And as gene-based approaches become even more commonly conducted, we have a better understanding of what the risks are. And I think it's easier for us to get these trials approved and opened.
Do you believe that the current status of gene-based therapy poses no more significant risk to human subjects or patients than traditional cytotoxic or other human subjects trials that we perform?
No, I think that some of these gene-based therapies have not insignificant side effects. So remember, chemotherapy, as an example, is a single event. There are pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetics that you can predict with the chemotherapy, and then it's pretty much metabolized and eliminated within a certain period of time. These gene-based therapies, and particularly cell-based therapies, basically you're giving a living therapy. You're giving a very small pellet of genetically engineered cells to a patient. You can barely see it at the bottom of an Eppendorf tube, and you give it to these patients, and these cells will expand by orders of magnitude. They traffic around the body, and they may persist in patients for weeks, months, or even years. And so the way we think about gene therapy, and in particular where you're altering the genome in these cells, has to be very different than a small molecule. And I think that that underscores both the potential of this living therapy as well as the risks that have to be identified and mitigated.
Something else that you alluded to in your Grand Rounds talk this morning was the importance of investing in young residents and junior faculty and maybe less traditional approaches to helping them with success, not a three-year startup package, but giving them the right environment. Compared to when you started, do you think that a successful basic science career is possible for young surgeons, or with funding challenges and pressures to clinically produce, are those days gone?
The early and mid portions of my career occurred in the golden era of NIH support, where the pay lines were in the 25 to 30% range. And then a sole investigator could set up a lab and have a technician and get a postdoc or a student, and to be able to stay funded as an individual investigator. Very difficult to do that now. And this is really a function of A, the explosion of scientific knowledge, and B, the regrettable circumstance that the pay lines are much lower. And I think those two factors, maybe even more the explosion of new knowledge of biology and physics, more than the pay lines, underscores the importance of young investigators, whether they're basic scientists, whether they're physician scientists, whether they're clinical investigators, that they find an infrastructure that is collaborative, that's team-based, that's focused, and one that supports the career and the intellectual curiosity and the individual scholarship of a junior investigator, while at the same time supporting a large team effort. So I can't emphasize enough the importance of environment, infrastructure, collaboration, and a leadership model that sublimates ego and self-interest for the betterment of that team effort.
Certainly, team building and leadership has been a common theme of what you've spoken about all morning. I was curious how you weigh inclusivity and exclusivity. I'm sure that you've had many, many people that have been interested in collaborating with you and your team that you've had to say no to, and you've done an excellent job of including people, as you repeatedly say, who are smarter than you. But how do you balance that as a leader?
So we build a small box, and we invite people into the small box that can embrace the same culture, that can contribute to the team effort, that are unselfish. Not that they shouldn't have some self-interest, but that they're fundamentally unselfish and that they're, more than anything else, interested in moving the science forward. And so you start with a small box, you build the box, you enlarge the box, but from time to time, you either need to not invite people to come join you, and occasionally have to uninvite people and ask them to leave the box. And so this small box model becoming a larger and larger team effort, it works, but it requires good leadership, and it requires good interaction among the team members.
Right. Unfortunately, we're almost out of time, but I have one final question on a more personal note. You are incredibly accomplished. You are president or past president of some of the most prestigious surgical societies. You are a leader of a multi-talented, multidisciplinary team. What of your professional accomplishments have been the most personally satisfying?
So first of all of the accolades that I've received, I think, are undeserved. I think I've been overrated most of my career. And it's mostly because I hang out with very smart people. When I wake up in the morning, I think of myself as a cancer surgeon, and I start worrying about my patients. During the day, I have to do a whole bunch of other things, but when I drive home at night, I think of myself as a cancer surgeon, and I worry about my patients. And the greatest satisfaction that I've had in my career is being able to help patients, either to help them with their disease or to help them emotionally in being able to deal with their disease. And everything else, at least professionally, is secondary.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for joining us on the Surgery Set.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. Join us next time when we're visited by Dr. Angela Gibson. She's a former nurse turned burn doctor who will discuss her involvement with the UW Burn Center and the incredible research she's been a part of involving methods of burn treatment. The Surgery Set is a production of the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This episode was produced by Rebecca Wasileski and myself. It was audio engineered by Chris Hansen and edited by Alex Worley. Our theme song is On Wisconsin, arranged and produced by Jamie Schmidt. I encourage you to visit us at surgery.wisc.edu, where you can find links to Grand Rounds, free CME credits, and more. You can also check out the UW School of Medicine and Public Health Video Library for a wide range of medical education resources at videos.med.wisc.edu. In addition, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. And of course, you can follow us on social media. You can like our Facebook page and also find us on Twitter at Wisc Surgery, as well as me at J.E. Kohler. Please feel free to let us know how we're doing, and especially let us know if there are topics you'd like us to cover. Thanks, and we hope you check back soon. On Wisconsin.